What's up, Gator Nation?
Good morning, Gator Nation.
You're listening to Gator Nation.
And the Gators have the biggest lead of the day.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WUMT.
From the University of Florida's College of Journalism and Communication.
3, 2, 1, we're live.
Hi, everyone. This is The Communicator, the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications podcast, where we dive into the latest in media, picking the brains of top faculty and staff around the Gator Nation. I'm Matt Abramson, Director of Media Services with Sophia Abulfadhi.
Happy to be here.
And Sophie Dominguez.
Hello.
Today, we're speaking with Janet Coates, Managing Director of the CJC's Consortium on Trust in Media and Technology. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for asking me. It's good to be here.
So you earned your bachelor's degree in journalism from the University of Missouri Columbia. What about journalism sparked your interest?
Well, I've always known I wanted to be a journalist. I was 8 years old and in third grade when I decided that that's what I wanted to do. And I never deviated from that path. I liked writing and my mom was a news junkie who made us watch the local news and read the paper. So I just was always interested in it.
Did you see yourself doing anything in particular? Do you want to be a reporter or an anchor?
I wanted to be a newspaper reporter or a magazine. Really, my dream was to be the White House correspondent for Time magazine. That was the goal.
Standing out front, Mr. President.
Exactly.
Excellent. So then right after college, you worked at several newspapers, serving in various roles. Tell us about those papers, your beats, and what that experience was like.
Sure. So the very first paper I worked at after college was a little 10,000 circulation daily newspaper in the Dallas area. So we did a little bit of everything. I covered City Hall, but I also covered weather, and I typed in the school lunch menus. And so it was a little bit of everything. It was a great experience. It really gave me a broad view of the business. Then I came to Florida and worked on the east coast of Florida at the Stuart Florida News, which was a paper that kind of outperformed itself. It was still a small paper, but with big ambitions. So I got to cover courts and schools and do some projects and investigative work. And that's where I first became an editor, was at the Stuart paper. So from there, I went to Virginia, to the Virginian Pilot. Was a reporter there, eventually became deputy managing editor of features and sports. So I was the only woman in the sports department and I was the boss. So that was an interesting experience. You had to kind of be, I had to prove that I actually knew something about sports. So fortunately, I grew up in Tennessee in an SEC world. So I knew football and knew baseball. So I could at least have that conversation.
Uh-oh, trigger warning to our Gator listeners.
I know. Well, I'm all Gator now. Let me be clear that I threw away all my Tennessee orange and replaced it with Gator orange. So completely converted. But then went to Wichita, Kansas, and was the managing editor of that paper. So that was the first time running a newsroom, which was fantastic. That's when I really knew, okay, this is what I want to do. I don't want to go work for Time magazine and cover the White House. I want to stay in local news. I want to run newsrooms. So that's what I did from there on. Came to Florida, was the executive managing editor and then executive editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Worked for my boss then was former Dean Diane McFarland, who was hired me in Sarasota. And then I was the editor of the Tampa Tribune, which sadly doesn't exist anymore. So that's kind of reflective of the state of newspapers.
Absolutely. Were there any stories that made a major impact in the communities that you were working in?
Oh, sure. There were a number of them. When I was in Virginia, I'm working as an investigative reporter. I uncovered all kinds of corruption with the city attorney who was, doing some shady things. And that really changed. He got fired. The city manager got in trouble. So those kinds of stories. But I think the ones that made the most difference in the community, when I was in Sarasota, we had a program that we developed that actually Dean McFarland was instrumental in starting. That was called Season of Sharing, where we put a spotlight on homeless youth in the community, which Sarasota is a very wealthy community, but it's a community of great disparity in income. So some very poor families in Sarasota as well. So the purpose of this was to put a spotlight on homeless families, the impact of homelessness on children, and give the community an opportunity to donate to a fund that served as an emergency relief fund for families at risk of homelessness. And that's been going on now for, gosh, almost 20 years. When I think about the number of families who've been helped by that, that's probably some of the work that I'm proudest of, is that really makes a difference beyond kind of political coverage. That really got into people who are truly in need.
So as you mentioned, in 1997, you began as a managing editor at Sarasota Herald Tribune, eventually becoming the executive editor. What did those roles entail? What were the differences?
So the difference between a managing editor and executive editor is really the difference between the offensive coordinator, to continue with sports here, between being the offensive coordinator and being the head coach. So the managing editor is really directing the players on the field, directing the daily coverage, making decisions about where to put reporters, what stories to pursue and what stories to let go to the side. So you're really the one who's creating, managing, directing the daily news report. The executive editor takes a longer view of things. So you're really thinking about strategy. You're thinking about, where do I want the newsroom to be in a month, in a year, in 5 years? Thinking about budgets, allocation of resources, staff development, community connection. So it's really that kind of more strategic view, and the managing editor is more tactical.
Which of those roles did you feel like you could lean into more and enjoy more?
Oh, I love them both. That's kind of choosing between, ice, vanilla and chocolate. I like them both. I think I was probably better at the executive editor role. I really like thinking strategically. I think you kind of feel like you're creating something that has, a longer life than just the next day's news.
Hey, it's Sophia here. So in the early 2000s, late 90s, the internet starts becoming more present in our lives. And then as such, we know the story is print journalism starts to fall to the side. So as you're working in newsrooms at that time, what started to change and how did you try to adapt to these changes?
So a number of things, it was really truly an evolution. I mean, I remember the first time that I was really aware of the internet as a presence was in 1995, when the bombing in Oklahoma City, where the federal building was bombed by a domestic terrorist. I was in Wichita, really close to Oklahoma City. I was sending teams of reporters down there, and one of my reporters came in, and information was coming in and kind of dribs and drabs. And one of my reporters came in and said, "You might want to, let's look at this thing called Yahoo, because it's an internet. People are posting things from there, like that's happening right
Whoa.
Now. So it was like, woo, science fiction. I can't believe that we can do this. And then, of course, the evolution was very fast. The move in technology was, when you look back on it now, especially, incredibly fast. And I think the biggest change for newsrooms is that we went to a 24-hour news cycle.
Oh.
So this idea, when you were a newspaper editor, you had one, maybe if you ran multiple editions of the newspaper, maybe you had two or three deadlines, but you had a finish line every day. So you spend all day collecting the news, writing the stories, editing them, taking the photos, all of that. And you're putting that all together in one package, and you hit the button at midnight, and then you're done. And you don't have an update on that product for another 24 hours. So news moved, it's certainly in print and in television too, because in those days, in the olden days, television meant a local newscast at 6 and a local newscast at 11. And the idea of 24-hour local news was only beginning. I mean, you had CNN, you had Fox, eventually you had MSNBC, but news was slower. There was more time for reflection. There was more time to say, hey, wait a minute. Maybe is this what we want to do? Is this the right picture? Do we really want to word it this way? You know, stories went through, which this is truly science fiction to people now, but a story would be edited by at least three people. And in some newsrooms, five or six. So there was this whole process of thoughtfulness and how do we improve it? How do we sharpen it? And with the internet, it turned into the world we live in now, which is, you know, if it's 30 seconds old, it's ancient history. It's that constant, it's happening right now. And that was a huge change from a culture that was very focused, very perfectionistic. You know, there was research done in the late 90s that the most perfectionistic cultures and the most risk-averse cultures in the professional world were the medical professions and the news and the journalism professions. And a lot of that had to do with the risk involved. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're a doctor and you aren't a perfectionist, you can kill somebody. If you're a journalist and you're not a perfectionist, you can destroy somebody's reputation. So that, you know, that went away to some extent. The time to be able to take that kind of approach. I mean, we had to really learn how to be willing to slow down and be willing to say, we may not be first with this, and that's going to be okay. And that's really hard to do. So, and then just the evolution from there of multimedia, you know, when we were first doing internet news in newsrooms, you couldn't put video up because I know it's so funny now, isn't it? Because the pipe wasn't big enough, you know, you had dial-up modems and just the capacity of the internet provider wasn't enough to, I mean, it was barely enough to put pictures up, much less, you know, video. So the change from a print-based approach to a video approach was another big shift that we're still going through a lot of that shift.
That is really interesting. It's almost shocking to hear that a article could go through five or six editors when now as students, we are super encouraged to have constantly updating Twitter accounts. Mm-hmm. For instance, as soon as mm-hmm. we see something, it has to go out on our Twitter. It has to go out on our story.
Right.
And so that's been completely disrupted, especially mm-hmm. as like citizen journalism right. has taken more of a stage. So I wonder right. what that means for the quality of information we're getting today.
Yeah. I worry about it. I think we may have been, I mean, there's a middle ground, right? I mean, five or six editors for, you know, a city council story out of Gainesville might have been a little excessive. and Gainesville, the Gainesville Sun at any stage wouldn't have had that many editors looking at a routine story. But especially for an investigative piece, for a piece that's sensitive, for a piece that is controversial, the more eyes you get, the more conversation you have, the better that's going to be. But the environment we live in, the expectation of the consumer, of the people who are receiving information is that it will be right this second. It really is I think that it continues to be knowing when to hold, when to say that, you know, it is more important to take a minute. It's more important to make sure that we have the information than it is to, you know, get it out there. You know, I remember, and this is more of a, it was internet too, but kind of before social, was when Gabrielle Giffords was shot, the congresswoman from Arizona, who's become such an advocate for gun control and gun regulation. NPR reported that she was dead. A lot of the, you know, internet sources reported that she was dead. Well, she, you know, obviously she wasn't dead. That's a pretty horrifying mistake. Let's take a minute. How do you know? One of the things I always really stressed in newsrooms was, how do you know what you know? How trustworthy is the source who's giving you this information? How do they know what they know? Did they see it? Did somebody else tell it to them? Did they read a document? How do they know this? And it's those instances where, you know, it's kind of the old cliche of a game of telephone. You pass it along, and eventually you kind of lose where it started. And for a journalist, you better doggone well know how the person who's giving you information knows it. That's the thing that we have to be willing to say, I'm going to sacrifice speed to make sure that the person who's telling me this has basis to know it.
Yeah, because your credibility is online.
Absolutely. And credibility is all we have. That is all we have in a world where in a world where there's such a proliferation of information, where we are in, you know, this information soup, the only thing that journalism has is credibility. That should be what separates us from content creators, a phrase I loathe. That should be the point of distinction. And we need to like guard that like it's a precious commodity, because it is.
So we're at this point in your career, we're about the early 2000s. As the print industry is continuing to change, how important was it then, but also now still, to better engage with our audience?
Yeah, sure. So I think that is one of the important things that changed. And when we're talking about the way things changed as we moved to a digital world where people could talk back to us more easily and could talk about us really easily. You know, I think for a lot of newspaper journalists and television journalists as well, it was the idea that we've done the reporting, we're kind of handing this information down from a mountaintop because we've done the reporting, here it is, the best available version of the truth today. You take it, we're going to throw it out the window at you. You take it and do with it what you will, without getting that kind of community feedback. That's one of the things, though, that I always loved about local news, is that it's really hard to not get community feedback if you're the editor of the local paper. I mean, I had an instance once when I had two small children when I was the editor in Sarasota. And I had both kids at the grocery store with me on a Saturday morning, and they're both having a fit. I need this sugar pops. I need, you know, this, that, and the other. Can we get chocolate milk? And one of them is sobbing. And somebody walked up to me and said, aren't you the editor of the Herald Tribune? That story that you had this past week, I didn't like. So, I mean, when you're in a local environment, the feedback just kind of comes. I think one of the things we've learned in the digital environment is that we need to seek it out more actively. You know, the role of my belief is that the role of a local news source, I always describe it, an editor at the Charlotte Observer back in the day, Jenny Buckner, used to describe the role of a newspaper as being a trusted friend. So you think about the friend you most trust, your best friend. That is the friend that you want to go to when you have happy news. That's one of the first people you want to share it with because they'll celebrate with you. So a news organization should do that. It's also that friend that you go to and say, can you give me your honest opinion?
The hard truth.
Exactly. And that truth will land because there's a relationship there. You have trust because you know that this person cares about you and has your best interest at heart. The only way that you can do that, either in a personal relationship or as an organization, and in this case, a news organization, is to be there, to be having that conversation, to show up for that person or that community. And you can't do that from, you know, behind a screen, behind your phone. That's a human connection.
In 2008, you then became the VP for news with the Florida Communications Group. How was this role different from the executive editor role? And what were some of the biggest challenges?
So the big difference there was that as VP for news, I wasn't just in charge of the Tampa Tribune, of the newspaper. I also had oversight of WFLA Channel 8's newsroom. So that's is the NBC affiliate station in Tampa, was the number one station at the time. I don't know where they are now, but the number one station in what was, I believe, then the 14th largest market in the country. I'm not a broadcast journalist. I had not, you know, been a television reporter. So now I had that newsroom and then the digital newsroom that served both the print and the television newsroom. We were all in one building. It was like the Innovation News Center is here. And in fact, the INC was modeled on some of the things we did in Tampa.
Oh, that's so cool.
With the time, what was called Convergence, where you brought news journalists from all different platforms together to work together and to, you know, have the print reporters who had more time to have that depth of reporting incorporated into the television reporting, to have the immediacy and the video storytelling that the television reporters were very strong at, have that move into the print and digital environment. So those were some of the first efforts. We did it in Sarasota as well, but those were some of the first efforts to really think about meeting the news consumer where they are. So, you know, from this one newsroom, we can serve you with a paper that we throw on your driveway every morning, or the 11 o'clock newscast that you watch every night, or the digital site that, you know, is on all the time. So it was really the first time that we were, Tampa and Sarasota were among the first in the country to really try to do all of these different platforms through one newsroom. So
were you a part of the group that initiated that multi-platform approach, or was that something that was already being experimented?
In Tampa, it was already being experimented with. I arrived in Sarasota not long after we were beginning the multimedia newsroom there. And in that case, it was, you know, the print editions, the website, and we had a 24-hour local cable news channel. So that was different, you know, doing 24-hour news. But I think the Herald Tribune maybe was the first true multimedia newsroom in the country.
After you left the Tampa Tribune, you started Coats to Coats. What exactly does your consultancy focus on?
Yeah, this was my husband left. He had a corporate job with Scripps at the time, and he left that job, and I left the Trib. I was, quite honestly, I was burned out. We had been laying people off in a steady stream, and you can only do that for so long before, you know, your soul is at risk. So it was time to do something else. We kind of stumbled into consulting. When I left the Tampa Tribune, I went to work as a consultant, as a contractor for a foundation in Sarasota that was looking to make investments in local news. And they didn't have any expertise in local news. So I worked with them to kind of figure out an investment strategy. What it eventually turned into, the consulting company, which was named after us, so Coats, and then the number two, and then Coats, a little too clever by half, but that's us. What we came to focus on were two things. My husband has been a journalist. Well, he'll say he's always a journalist till he dies, but which is true. But he had worked on the revenue side. I had been more on the editorial side of things. So we worked with newsrooms on both revenue strategy and editorial strategy. And where we ended up doing most of that work was in public media. So again, I'd never been a public radio journalist. You know, as you can tell from listening to this podcast, I don't exactly have a voice for Morning Edition, but so I wasn't familiar with public media. But the reason they brought us in is that public radio newsrooms were growing at a time when print newsrooms were collapsing. And public radio newsrooms did not have a most of them did not have a rich tradition of original reporting, and certainly original in-depth reporting. So they're building news capacity, and they needed somebody to help teach them how to do that. So for most of 10 years, I worked with public radio newsrooms. I worked with WAMU in Washington, with KUOW in Seattle, KUT in Austin, St. Louis Public Radio. So, you know, I kind of got all around and really got a chance to see what that side of the journalism world looks like.
And it's different for those who are not aware of the commercial media versus public media. Can you give us your kind of cliff notes on that?
Sure. So, you know, I always say that the difference between commercial media and nonprofit or public media is, I mean, technically the difference is a tax status, right? Mm-hmm. So both of them have to make money. And I think there is a misconception that public media or nonprofit media doesn't need to make money. Well, you know, nothing is free in this world. So everybody's got to raise money, have revenue. The difference is that commercial media is serving shareholders. It's serving the interest of the corporation. There are still a few family-owned news organizations, but for the most part, they're corporate-owned, and you've got to make those shareholders happy. So that influences your decisions about how much you cover, what resources you're able to put to it. For public media, it really truly is a service mission. So you got to make enough money to pay the bills, pay your staff, pay for what the work you're doing, but it's for a public service purpose. And then there are tote bags. So that's the other difference.
And really cool bandanas and cool mugs.
And socks. Some of them have socks.
Absolutely. So. I'm a public radio nerd myself.
This is Sophie. So as you were working in this new capacity with your consultancy, can you share a specific example of a client you worked with and how you helped coach them and their business?
Well, the first public media client we had was St. Louis Public Radio, which at the time was interested in developing a collaboration with an independent news organization in St. Louis that had been started by people who had worked at the newspaper there, who the newspaper was cutting positions. And so these journalists started their own news organization. So there was this idea of, can we collaborate together? And when we got there and started looking at collaboration opportunities, it became clear pretty quickly that combining operations would probably be a smart way to go, because they had such complementary skill sets and institutional knowledge of the community. And they also had some donor crossover because the independent was a nonprofit. And some of the donors were like, yeah, we'll give you more money if you're working together because we think your impact would be higher. So that was the first public media independent news organization merger where they actually went from not just collaboration, but a true merger. That really has set the kind of the model for more of that. So, for instance, right now, the public radio station in Chicago and the Chicago Sun-Times, the public radio station bought the Chicago Sun-Times. So that became one newsroom. There are a number of other independent startups that have become part of their public radio newsroom. So that, you know, we were really early to thinking about that. And I like to look at that and think, hey, you know, we had an impact that went beyond just that one consulting job.
Did you ever have to think about like audience retention, like the distinct audiences, and then kind of like merging them together, how to keep everyone engaged?
Yeah. And that is definitely, that's an issue both from content news consumer side and the revenue side, because, you know, that there can be that crossover between donors and trying to make the case that not only should you continue your commitment, you should up it, because here's the impact that this combined organization has. that's can be a hard case to make. Fortunately, my husband had to make that case and not me. But yeah, thinking about the metrics of that, how are you tracking audience when it's not just in one format? How do we kind of reach back to people who've already had contact, had already been, listeners or viewers, readers, trying to kind of combine the knowledge on both sides of that so that you are creating the kind of databases and dashboards that let you really know, okay, who's engaging with us? How are they engaging with us? Can we expand their engagement beyond listening to us to opening our newsletter or, reading something on our app? So, it really did change the strategic approach for those organizations.
So you were also a juror for the Pulitzer Prize mm-hmm. on several occasions, including as chair of the Public Service and Investigative Reporting juries. What makes a strong piece of investigative reporting and thus a winning submission?
And let me tell you, you read some amazing things when you're judging both of those categories. I think the thing that makes for a winning Pulitzer entry is it really comes back to impact. Can you show that through your investigation made a difference? And made a significant difference, that something was changed, that a wrong was righted, that a problem that had been kind of maybe even under the radar, that wasn't getting the kind of focus that it should, were you able to expose that? Were you able then for your reporting to make a difference? And there's lots of reporting that does that. So then it comes down to how well you execute. So it's, yes, we made a difference and, we had to, file 47 Freedom of Information Act requests to get this data, or, we had to convince people to talk to us who didn't want to. And then, how you present the information, it comes down to those things. And, when you judge, in the instance when I judged investigative, you're over the course of 2.5 days, at least it was, I think that's different now, but you were reading probably 100 different entries, all of which were 5-part series, that were super long. The stuff that stands, there are just things that jump out at you because they're particularly well done and there's significant impact and you're like, oh yeah, that one stands out.
I'm Glenn Richards from WUFT Amplified. If you're like me, you appreciate how special the local music scene is here in North Central Florida, featuring indie rock, hip hop, bluegrass, and so much more. WUFT Amplified is Florida's music series, filmed right here in Weimar Hall. This show rocks, guys, seriously. And you might not realize that WUFT Amplified is produced entirely by UFCJC staff and students. To watch past episodes and discover your new favorite bands, check out wuft.org/amplified.
Then in 2018, you became the Executive Director for Innovation and Strategy at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications. How did you end up going from Florida to Arizona?
Well, first, I only work for things that have really long names,
yes,
as you know, from my job here at CJC and in UF. I wound up doing work for the Cronkite School, which is based at Arizona State University, out of my consulting work, because I had worked with the then dean of the Cronkite School on a proposal to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for a grant, for $1 million grant. And that grant we were successful in getting that grant. And the dean said, hey, we don't have anybody here who really does this. Would you be interested in working for us full time? At that point, I'd been doing consulting for 9 years. There were a lot of benefits to working with a single employer. I mean, being a consultant, you're constantly in client acquisition mode. You're, you know, trying to build the business all the time. This was, you know, one job, one employer, state health insurance. That was not a small piece of it. But I didn't actually, and the other piece that made it attractive was, at least initially, I didn't have to leave Florida. They would let me do it remotely. So I would go to Phoenix 1 week a month. The rest of the time I was, we were still in Sarasota then. So it was kind of a perfect world when I started, because I was doing remote work before that was cool, before we were using Zoom and everybody was used to that kind of hybrid approach. Now, I eventually did go when they expanded my portfolio so that I was in charge of like hiring the adjunct faculty, and I ran the media literacy program there and a few other things. So when my role was expanded, they needed me to actually be in Phoenix. So I rented an apartment in downtown Phoenix while we were figuring out, you know, are we going to try to, like, we eventually want to retire in Florida. What do we do? Do we want to, like, move wholesale to Arizona? But I moved into this apartment in Phoenix the day after January 2nd, 2020. I came back to Florida for ASU spring break, and I never went back. Because of the pandemic.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Slipped my mind. I never even set foot in the apartment again. We moved my stuff. You know, we just hired a moving company and they let us in to do it. I kept working at ASU through 2020 because then remote really didn't matter. We were all remote. And then I wound up in a conversation with Dean McFarland about the consortium job, which they had looked at several different models for how they wanted to fill that job, whether they wanted an academic to fill that job, somebody who was a researcher, somebody with a PhD. And eventually they came to the idea that what they wanted was, you know, an operator, somebody who could kind of run the day-to-day and the logistics of it and enable the researchers to do their work. So that was the evolution of going from ASU to UF.
What is the Consortium on Trust in Media and Technology? And as the founding managing director, were you starting at square one?
Well, so what the consortium is, it was originally funded by UF as part of the moon launch initiatives. So there was the provost at the time created this bucket of money for, you know, colleges to make proposals that would be focused on a big problem, a moonshot. We need to get from where we are to the moon. And the proposal from CJC was around trust and kind of mirroring the idea that I think it's fairly obvious to most. I mean, we're in a trust crisis and it's, you know, a U.S. crisis, but it's truly a global crisis. So in this crisis, kind of the two pieces that are moving, kind of the tectonic plates that move against each other are news, journalism, you know, the media environment and the tech environment, because they've become so intertwined. And, you know, I think people have come not to trust the news. I mean, Gallup just had a poll out in October that for the first time, the lines crossed and more people have no trust for the media at all than have a great deal of trust in the media. So for the first time in the years and years that they've been doing that poll, that line has crossed.
Is there a component of digital literacy or lack thereof? People that think that they don't trust the media, but maybe don't fully understand who the media is,
yes,
and what those goals are,
yes,
for the organizations.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't, even though media is in the name of the consortium, I kind of hate the word media because the media is, you know, that's a big label and a lot of things fall under that. You know, it can be, you know, I mean, The Onion is media.
Influencers.
It can be influencers, you know, people who have huge followings on TikTok. They're the media now.
Like it or not, but yeah. You are now.
Yeah. So I think some of it is not understanding the mission, what makes news different from other content. Part of that is that journalists have never explained their work very well. We've kind of kept this air of mystery. And, you know, media, you know, long before the internet, depictions of journalists in the popular media have not been always been favorable. You know, the journalist often does something shady to get the information, you know, things that aren't part of reality. But we haven't done, you know, the explaining. One of the things I love about the movie Spotlight, which is about the Boston Globe's coverage of the child sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church, which the Globe really was the one, talk about investigative journalism, they were really the ones who uncovered it. Somehow they made a movie that made investigative reporting look really suspenseful and interesting by showing what investigative reporting really is. I mean, they're going through documents, they're knocking on doors, they're, you know, it's things don't come together in, you know, a quick, dramatic way. We haven't explained that. We haven't explained that this is rigorous, that we don't just toss things out there, that there is a, you know, that this is a culture of verified information. And in a world, you have to do it again, in a world where verification is, you know, a lost art, being able to explain, yes, this is what makes us distinctive. That's something I think journalists need to be very focused on, the transparency of their reporting, explaining decision making. But part of it too, I mean, it can't just be on the journalist side. It can't just be all on us to say, well, here, let me make this transparent. We have to do a better job of teaching people how to distinguish quality information from junk. From either disinformation, which is intentional, you set out to deceive somebody, or misinformation, which doesn't have that intention, but is stuff that just gets shared around because, you know, I saw this on my friend's, you know, Instagram and I shared it and I didn't check it out and it's completely not true. So more media literacy training in starting, you know, in kindergarten, truly. We need to help people be appropriately skeptical of the information that they're seeing. And that's even more true now as we move into an age where AI is a big player in the media world.
So, Janet, what is the current state of trust in media and technology right now? Is it bright? Is it getting darker?
It's fairly grim. You know, I was just mentioning the report from the Gallup polling where, you know, that's very recent that shows there's just not trust. I think it's, you know, on my days when I'm feeling depressed about all of it, it's daunting. It is daunting to think about rebuilding those relationships. And as I was saying, in a world now where generative AI, I mean, you can't trust your eyes, you can't trust your ears. This could be completely fabricated, and it's information that can be fabricated very, very easily by anybody. I mean, I could go downstairs and, you know, create an image using generative AI that could make you think that, you know, Matt, you were doing something shady when this isn't Matt and you're not doing that. So the challenges keep getting bigger and the hole is deep and getting deeper. So we have to start thinking in a more strategic way about how do we help stop that disintegration of trust. And it's tough. We're in such a polarized environment. People live in echo chambers. They don't hear things that counter their own viewpoint. We tend to think that, you know, our viewpoint is right and the person who has a counter viewpoint is wrong, and we don't recognize that there's lots of gray. The world lives in gray, and we want to paint it in black and white.
So you mentioned generative AI and its potential to kind of mislead people. As we brace an election this year, kind of what do you think is what are your thoughts on the use of generative AI and how it can impact these elections, this race?
Sure. Embrace is the right word, too, because I think we're all just kind of like holding on to the edge of the table in abject terror about what the election looks like. Not so much in terms of, you know, everybody's got their candidate, but just in the messiness of it. And it's exhausting, everything that's coming at us in terms of information. You know, we've already seen instances. They're just recently, in the past month, there was the instance in New Hampshire of a AI-generated phone call, one of the robocalls that was purported to be from President Biden. And I mean, it sounds just like him, just exactly like him, calling to say, don't vote on Tuesday if you're a Democrat, because if you vote on Tuesday, you know, it's only helping to elect Trump. You know, that has been kind of the first. There were some things in the about a year ago in the Republican primary, but that there wasn't anything nearly as dramatic as that. I'm concerned. I worry about not just the ability to, you know, paint a picture of somebody doing something wrong, but when they're not, but also to erase somebody actually doing something wrong by, you know, pushing out information that, you know, negates that. It can be used in both directions. And right now, in truth, the detection, there isn't anything. There isn't a technology that detects with reliability that this was AI generated. Now, I mean, people here at UF are working on it. People at universities and in tech all over are working at, you know, can we use the very tools that are causing the problem to detect the problem? It's not there yet. So we are left to rely on our gut to a certain extent. And that kind of gets you back to the media literacy piece is, you know, does this feel true? Is this counter to what you would think this person was saying? I mean, do you really think Joe Biden would tell anybody not to vote? I mean, that just the message of it, if you stop and think for a minute, is like, well, that doesn't sound right. And then that gets us back to journalists and to journalists who are chasing down that this is happening. This robocall is going on. Now let's dig into it and see, you know, what we can learn about its origin. But it's scary. And we've only seen a little bit of it. As we get towards the general election, I think it's going to get really, really ugly.
Kind of thinking about the brighter side of things, do you think generative AI has positive uses for journalism, for media?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's the rare thing that is either all good or all bad. There are things, but in this instance, there are definitely good uses of generative AI. I mean, when I look at it and think about, you know, when I was a reporter, just being able to, you know, research a topic very quickly. I mean, if you put a prompt in to ChatGPT, the information you get back comes back so fast, so much faster than you would get in Google. Now, you still have to, you know, verify. AI does, as they say, hallucinate. It makes stuff up. I had asked ChatGPT to generate my bio, It gave me a PhD. I have a bachelor's, but I kid all the time.
If I'd
known it was so easy to get a PhD, they act like it's so hard. I would have done it long ago. You know, it listed academic articles I'd written, which is really wild. I mean, you can get to me having a PhD based on my job, but to generate, here's academic articles you wrote. So again, now I'm going back into the bad side, but from a research perspective, from, you know, helping you generate ideas, generate leads, even, you know, kind of giving you, I will sometimes for things I'm writing, put that text into ChatGPT and ask it to simplify it. And I wouldn't use that simplified information in a publication, but it is a great way to help you look at things and say, boy, I'm making that overly complicated. How can I, you know, make that clearer? So there's definitely editing functions and research functions that can be really positive.
As students start to work in the field, how can they ensure the credibility of themselves and journalism as a whole are maintained in the digital age?
Well, I mean, that's a big task. I think we get back to some of the ideas of transparency. You know, from my perspective, the more transparency, the better. And learning as a young journalist to make it clear, this is where I got this information, or explain. One of the things we need to explain sometimes is, you know, who we didn't talk to and why. We weren't able to, you know, we made this many attempts and we weren't able to get this person to talk to us, or, you know, here's why this information isn't included. It's anticipating the question that a user might have, a reader, viewer, user might have, and trying to answer it and be clear about it. You know, I think there's some interesting experiments going on in newsrooms about reporters being more transparent about themselves, saying, you know, in my case, saying, you know, I grew up in Tennessee and I, you know, went to Mizzou and, you know, now I'm at UF, but I'm a UF fan in football and baseball and not these other SEC schools. I mean, just kind of saying where you come from and why you have, what your credibility is in what you report on. I cover courts and I have done that for this period of time. And, you know, here's how I prepare myself for that work. All those kinds of transparency and thinking about how do I connect with the community? How do I make sure that I am really serving as the community, serving as the eyes and ears of the community? We are currently thinking a lot in the consortium about the ideas, the concepts of authenticity, intention, and precision. That as a journalist, if you're really trying to reflect a community authentically, that means you're using the language of that community. It means that you are, you know, presenting that community to the rest of your audience, the rest of your community, in a way that they recognize themselves. You're telling their story in their words. That from an intention standpoint, you're clear about the purpose of your work and you're upfront about that. We're doing this story because, and not being afraid to say that. And then the precision piece, I mean, precision is more than accuracy. You can get something right and not be precise about it. I think precision more than just about anything helps people say, yeah, okay, that's credible. You're not saying that it cost about a dollar. You're saying it cost $1.12. I mean, you're being really precise in your language, in the facts you're presenting. I mean, that I think still resonates with people.
Excellent. Well, Janet, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope we've added more truth and more transparency to the process, sharing the story, your story, with our viewers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Communicator Podcast is a production of UF's College of Journalism and Communications. This episode is produced by Sophie Dominguez.
thanks to our guest Janet Coates, hosted by Matt Abramson, and featuring Sophia Abelfavi and Sophie Dominguez. Special thanks to WUFT. Go Gators!